Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Scholarship on Mithra is remarkably rich in both scope and depth, and it has the added advantage of continual renewal, particularly in light of new discoveries, exhibitions, and publications. Mithraism and its mystery remain an inexhaustible source of fascination. In recent decades alone, one may point to new discoveries in Roman Syria, most notably the Mithraeum at Saido in southern Lebanon, which prompted a conference in Lyon. More recently, in 2022, a major exhibition was devoted to the Roman cult, first at the Royal Museum of Marimont in Belgium, then at the Archaeological Museum of Toulouse, and subsequently in Frankfurt. In the conclusions of the Conference on Mithraism in Syria, Robert Turcan, one of the foremost contributors to Mithraic studies, wrote, "Naturally, studying Mithras in Syria means revisiting the question of the origins and the development of the Bull Slayer and the transformations he underwent during his remarkably successful exile in the West. We must never lose sight of his Iranian roots, and France Grenet has provided us with some remarkable examples of this in Central Asia." End of quote. These remarks, in fact, underscore the radical distance that Mithraic studies have taken from the Iranian origins of Mithra since the period just before the 2000s. Turcan, who is the last major defender of an Iranian continuity of Mithra between Iran and Rome, calls for a return of these foundational sources. The dialogue between the Roman Mithras and the Zoroastrian Mithras appear to have been broken for many years. Is it possible that they no longer have anything to say to one another? In major scholarly and public engagements devoted to the former, specialists of the latter are typically present only to recall long-forgotten ancient roots, remaining, in effect, peripheral to the interpretation of the Roman religion. The relationship between Roman Mithras and Zoroastrian Mithra thus resembles, in a sense, that of Hamlet turning away from his father's ghost. He consciously rejects his origin, yet continues to speak in echoes of it. This workshop seeks to take up the significant challenges posed by this bipolarity of Mithra in the aftermath of a period dominated by the theory of Hans Cumont. While Cumont's continuity model has been rightly contested, it has not yet been replaced by a fully satisfactory alternative. The mystery of Mithra, therefore, remains unresolved. Ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, dear students, it is a great honor for me to open this workshop dedicated to Mithra in dialogue. I would like to express my gratitude to Nina Marju and France Grenet for inviting me to present one aspect of the Iranian Mithra. In order to preserve a genuinely dialogical perspective, I will, insofar as possible and within the limits of my expertise in Greco-Roman material, make some references to the Mithraic cult. Today, I propose to structure my remarks around three main topics. First, I will begin with a brief overview of the Iranian contribution to Mithraic studies, an element of the Persianization, whether genuine or constructed, of the Roman cults of Mithra. Second, I will focus on the primary function of the Iranian deity, namely his role as guardian and embodiment of a social phenomenon, the covenant, the contract, and by extension, the oath. Finally, I will conclude with an overview of what we know about the Iranian festival dedicated to this god, Mithrakana or Mihragan. The very abundant material remains of the Mithraic cult attest to its diffusion throughout the Mediterranean basin and its implantation across all levels of society over nearly four centuries. yet they remain strikingly silent regarding its arrival from the East. This silence has given rise to a number of theories, among which that of Hans Cumont long held a dominant position for several decades. According to his diffusionist model, Mithraism originated in Zoroastrianism, passed through a Babylonian and Anatolian filter, and subsequently entered the Roman Empire. This framework makes it possible to bridge several academic fields, and at the time of the emergence of Mithraic studies, this intellectual construction was conceived as explicitly inclusive. The Indian Mitra, the Iranian Mithra, and the Roman Mithras were understood as points along a continuous historical and religious trajectory. Still under the intellectual influence of Cumont's model, and in the context of a 2,500-year celebration of the Persian Empire, a major congress was organized in 1971 in Manchester, funded by Iran. At this stage, however, a clear shift emerged away from Cumont's paradigm in favor of a reinterpretation, notably by Gordon and Hinnells, of Mithraism as a distinctively Greco-Roman religion characterized by secret initiatory practices structured around themes of death and rebirth. This was followed in 1975 by a Congress on Mithraic Studies held in Tehran, which arguably also reflected a political agenda. Both conferences and the proceedings subsequently published received critical responses. As Jung observed, in both congresses, prominent scholars in the field of Indian and Iranian studies have contributed papers which deal with many aspects of Mitra and Mithra. Their contributions are of great importance for Indo-Iranian studies, even though some have little or no bearing in the study of Iranian origin of Roman Mithraism. Subsequently, Mesopotamia was excluded from the proposed transmission chain, and scholarly attention shifted towards regions formerly under Achaemenid control, where Mithraic worship is attested, albeit not necessarily in an initiatory form, such as Comagene or the Kingdom of Pontus. Mithraism was then increasingly framed as a purely Roman phenomenon, although its Iranian connection were not entirely dismissed. This Iranization of Roman Mithraism, notably reinforced through influential translations of Martin Vermazren works in Persian, has unintended consequences for Iranian archaeology, as if anticipating Richard Fry's warning, the aberrant forms of the cult of Western Mithraism are not found in Iran, unless archaeologists or ethnologists one day uncover traces of some of the practices of Western Mithraism in the mountains of Kurdistan. The consequence was that virtually any vaulted Parthian structure whose function could not be securely identified began to be interpreted as a Mithraic temple. And this interpretative overreach has even left traces in popular references works such as Wikipedia. I suppose that this will be the subject of next week's conference by Professor Darry, so I shall leave it here. We encounter two categories of elements that may evoke Persia. On the one hand, authentic, documented, and deliberate references to ancient Persia. On the other, representations that the Romans associated with the East or with Persia, drawing on stereotypes inherited from the Hellenistic period. These elements fall under what Richard Gordon has termed Persianism, a concept used to describe the Greco-Roman strategies of appropriating the Persian god. In the Mithraic context, such appropriation, intentionally promoted by Mithraic mystagogues, served to emphasize and legitimize the Persian origin of the deity, thereby presenting Mithras as rooted in ancient Eastern wisdom. Among these Persianizing features, the most familiar and visually prominent within Mithraic iconography is the so-called Oriental dress, worn by Mithras and the Dadophorus. This consists of sleeved tunic, trousers, and a Phrygian cap, all of which constitute the conventional Greco-Roman visual vocabulary for signifying Persian identity. The most salient of these attributes is the Phrygian cap, an image that could function metonymically to designate the cult as a whole, and which is also employed as an emblem of the highest rank within the initiatory hierarchy, namely that of the patres. Another Greek topos, identified by Richard Gordon in his article of 2017, is the depiction of Mithras and an archer, or alternatively, the representation of the bow and arrow alone, and sometimes within what appear to be scenes of initiations, for example, on this vase discovered in Mainz in the 19th. The bow also features prominently, in one of Mithra's exploits, commonly referred to as the water miracle, in which he shoots an arrow into a rock, thereby causing water to miraculously gush forth. He is also depicted as a mountain archer in a hunting scene inspired by Parthian or Sasanian visual traditions, as evidenced by the material found in Dura Oropus in 1933. Both archery and hunting belong to the Greek conceptual repertoire associated with the education of Persians. Unlike archery, however, the hunting motif has not been satisfactorily explained within the framework of Roman cult practice. It may therefore serve primarily as a visual justification of Mithra's epithet, Invictus. I will now turn to a closer examination of linguistic Persianizing features, which are relatively few in number, but some of them remain particularly difficult to interpret. Although the transmission routes of Mithras to Rome did not proceed directly from Persia, the name Mithras, or Mithra, or Mithras, is nevertheless clearly fashioned as that of deity belonging to the Persian religious tradition and is accordingly associated with Zoroaster, as Porphyry reports in the century CE. The form of the name in itself is noteworthy. It is evidently derived from the old Persian form of the theonym in its Indo-Iranian, that is, Avestan guise, with Greek typically rendering the Iranian voiceless dental fricative by theta. It should nevertheless be noted that at the time of the flourishing of Roman Mithraism under the Parthian and subsequently Sasanian empires, the same deity, or rather its contemporary double, was no longer venerated under the same name Mithra, but rather as Mihra, reflecting a regular phonetic development within the Middle Iranian languages. The Latin form of the name and its divergence from the contemporary Persian designation therefore suggest a deliberate appeal to an archaic form meditated through Greek transmission. And this supports the hypothesis of a conscious Hellenization of the Roman cult. For most Latin ears, the names of Mithra's two attendants, Chaotes and Chaotopates, would have sounded Greek. In reality, however, this name appeared to preserve some Iranian phonetic material, albeit transmitted through Greek mediation. Philologists have therefore attempted to explain both names either through Iranian roots or through Greek etymologies, with only limited success. Since Chaotes raises his torch, while Kaopates lowers his, scholars have naturally sought explanations connected to their functions as torchbearers, although more recent interpretations tend to favor representation of sunrise and sunset, or more broadly of astronomical or astrological phenomena, in line with interpretation to which Nina Majdi has drawn attention in her doctoral dissertation. The most recent Iranian etymology that has been proposed, though it has not become a standard reference, is that of Martin Schwartz. According to Schwartz, Kauta would derive from Iranian Kauta, meaning young, a term that would evoke the youthful, beardless appearance of Mithras and his companions, understood as an expression of physical perfection in Iranian cultural ideas. As for Kaotopates, the second element has been interpreted as reflecting the Iranian suffix pati, meaning chief, master, lord, although this formation is not attested in a divine epithet in Old Iranian. Alternatively, Schwartz relates it to pata, a nominative form of patar, protector, drawing on the frequency of the root pa to protect in Avestan, the Avestan text dedicated to Mithra, the Avestan Yasht, the 10th Yasht of the Avesta. According to this interpretation, the two torchbearers would constitute a reduced and duplicated manifestation of Mithras himself. The philological details, however, remain highly speculative despite considerable scholarly effort. And other scholars of Iranian religion have proposed instead that these two figures reflect the two companions of Mithra in Zoroastrian text, both in the Avesta, particularly in the Yashten, but also in Middle Persian Zoroastrian literature, Sraosha and Rashnu. Sraosha, associated with the morning prayers and protective functions, is symbolically linked with the rooster in the Iranian mythology, while Rashnu embodies justice and presides over the wheeling, the weighing of the souls after death with his scale. As you can see in this table of correspondence, while the parallel between Kautes and Sraosha is indeed striking, the same cannot be said for Kaotopates and Rashnu. Moreover, since astrological interpretations have added yet another layer of explanation to these figures, the Zoroastrian dimension of the debate has become increasingly marginalized. This is the rooster and the owl. The epithet Nabarze, attested in several votive stelae, is relatively rare. It has generally been interpreted as the Persian equivalent of Invictus. Here again, however, several Iranian etymologies have been proposed, none of which has achieved scholarly consensus. It is nonetheless generally agreed that the form is connected to the root Barz, which conveys notion of greatness, elevation, and exaltation, and which is frequently attested in Achaemenid Persian onomastics. For a more cautious perspective, however, it may be more plausible to regard this epithet of Mithra simply as an abbreviated form of the name of the well-known Kiliarch of Darius III, Nabarzanes, who, in alliance with the satrap of Bactria, Bessus, conspired against the king and ultimately surrendered to Alexander the Great. Nama. With the term Nama, we finally reach a consensus regarding a directly Iranian origin. In the Mithraic context, the term is widely attested from the 2nd century CE onward in formulae of homage, typically followed by the name or epithet of the god or of the participants of the cult. It may be understood as reflecting a deliberate Persianism of the Roman cultic vocabulary. In its Iranian usage, the term is well attested in Avestan, where it designates a specific liturgical genre often associated with blood sacrifice. The Mithraic lexicon still contains further cases of Persianizing elements, although some remains problematic, and I therefore leave the discussion for two other contributors. This pronounced emphasis on Persian elements, both visual and terminological, is generally understood as reflecting the mystagogue's deliberate construction of a distinctive identity for the Mithraic community. What is thereby presented is less a faithful representation of Iranian religious reality than a projection shaped by Greco-Roman imaginings of Persia. A comparable phenomenon can also be observed in the Roman cults of Egypt. In this perspective, such Persianizing features functioned as markers of antiquity and venerability, thereby facilitating the integration of the cult within the religious pluralism of the Roman Empire. En faisant le pari d'une altérité choisie et incluse, certaines communautés mithriaques ont ainsi consolidé l'identité des groupes, facilité la permanence du culte et sans doute favorisé sa pratique jusqu'au 5e siècle. Yet the dialogue between Mithras and Mitra is not limited to lexical bearings. Correspondences have also been proposed at the level of religious concept and ritual motifs. I will briefly review some of them without entering into detailed discussion. First, the Petrogeny, the figure of the rock-born god, is not without resonance with the emergence of Mithras from behind the mythical mountain Hara, as it's well described in his Yasht in the 13th paragraph. And I guess Franz Grenet will address this topic in the workshop in December. The cave, or the speleum, or Mithra's dwelling, actually, the star-filled space and the microcosmic environment represented in the main chamber of the Mithra temple also recall, in certain respects, the enclosures described in Avestan text, which possess their own intrinsic lights and are portrayed as enclosed spaces outside ordinary terrestrial time and space. The most immediate example is the enclosure constructed by Yima in the Videvda 2. Yet, regarding the Yasht of Mithra, the Yasht 1050, one also finds that Mithra possesses a comparable magical dwelling built for him by Ahura Mazda himself within the mountain Hara. Now, tauroctony. As the Mithraic tauroctony, Zoroastrian mythology likewise includes the sacrificial motif of a primordial white bull called Hadayosh. And this topic is will be addressed in the second part of the workshop by Professor Antonio Panaino. The cosmic role is also an important common part. Both Mithras and Mithra are deity endowed with cosmic, very important cosmic functions. While Mithras restores cosmic order through tauroctony, Zoroastrian Mithra safeguards order and contractual relations continuously by crossing the heavens in his solar chariot by day and by night. Both figures are also associated with fertility and the abundance of water. I have already alluded to the miracle of water in the Mithraic myth. The connection between the Zoroastrian deity and water is more indirect, yet he is nonetheless described as replenisher of waters, thanks to whom waters fall and plants grow. And most significantly, his most frequent epithet is Vauru Gaoyauti, Mithra who provides wide grazing grounds, which makes him one of the principal guarantors of prosperity in an agro-pastoral society. The photo that you see on the right has been taken a few weeks ago in the Mithraeum discovered beneath the Basilica of San Clemente in Rome, and the temple was built over a water source. As you can see in the picture, Mithraic devotees still today throw coins into Mithra spring. I'm not sure you can see the coins in just below the water. Well, this is also the Mithraic altar in the same basilica. Finally, another possible point of convergence between Mithras and Mithra lies in their social function. In the Roman world, fides, that is loyalty, trustworthiness, and fidelity, constitute a central virtue. Within Mithraic communities, initiation into the mysteries strengthened the bond linking initiates to one another, while the dexiosis, a ritual-sealed membership in the group of sundexoi, those united by the handshake. This gesture reproduces that exchange between the pater and the newly initiated adept, which in turn mirrors the handshake between Mithras and the son. This aspect may be understood as a continuation in the Cumonthian sense of the principal function of Zoroastrian Mithra as guardian of contracts. It is worth noting, moreover, that the term dexiosis, in the sense of concluding an agreement through a handshake, finds a very close parallel in Avestan, zasta marshta, denoting a contract, again, sealed through a literal rubbing of hands. This primary function is embedded in the very name Mithra itself, which, since the article by Antoine Meillet in 1907, is understood in Sanskrit and Avestan to signify covenant, agreement, treaty, alliance, promise. This semantic value of the theonym was not preserved in the other liturgical language of Zoroastrianism, Middle Persian, where it was replaced by different lexical forms. In Sanskrit, the word additionally carries the meaning friend, since friendship is by definition grounded in the observance of an alliance. In New Persian, mehr subsequently came to denote affection, friendship, and even love. And it also functions as a literary designation of the sun. Within a polytheistic system in which most deities embody natural forces or human emotions, it is particularly striking that Mithra is the only deity who represents a social phenomenon, a binding convention that unites two parties. From the outset, the Yasht dedicated to him emphasizes that the Mithra, the covenant, must be upheld even when the other party is aligned with evil, Dhruvant. Since a contract applies without any exception or mitigation, a substantial portion of the text is devoted to detailing the severe punishments that the god inflicts on the Mithrodruj, the one who breaks the covenant. This reveals another facet of Mithra's personality, his aggressive and vengeful nature. while he protects and generously rewards those who uphold contractual relations, granting them prosperity, cattle, horses, he also unleashes terrible retribution upon covenant breakers and demons. Mithra is described as wielding a golden mace, and his chariot is filled with thousands of bows, arrows, spears, and daggers. The brilliance of these weapons causes even Ahriman and the demons of wrath, Aeshma, to tremble. He is thus a god of vengeance, whose very presence strikes fear into his adversaries. One cannot discuss Mithra's multifaceted personality without addressing his solar aspect. The Avestan Mithra is not the sun itself, but rather embodies the sunrise, the light of dawn, and according to Jean Kellen's interpretation, the ritual moment between sunrise and midday, Ratu Havani. Yet, although the Iranian pantheon includes a distinct solar deity, Khwar Shaeta, this did not prevent the eventual identification of Mithra with the sun. This association of Mithra with the sun is first explicitly attested in a Greek source, Strabo in the first century BCE, who stated that in their worship, the Persian called the sun Mithra. Confronted with this complex personality and its exceptionally diverse range of attributes, scholars have proposed a variety of interpretative frameworks. The first approach, proposed among others by Paul Thiem and Ilya Gershevich, advances an evolutionary model. Mithra's martial activity is derived from his function as guardian of contracts, or alternatively, his continuous surveillance over treaties from heaven is understood to have gradually led to his association with the light of dawn. This theory is opposed to another interpretative framework, which defines the Iranian Mithra in relation to the Vedic divine pair Mithra-Varuna. Within this dyad, Varuna represents the regressive force of subterranean waters and the nocturnal sky, whereas Mithra embodies the corresponding progressive force, which accounts for his role as god of the rising sun, the light, and of life. As such, he functions as a mediator between the realms of light and darkness and personifies the cosmic contract. This position is held by Franz Kuiper, his analysis in 1961 in the very severe review of Gershevich's edition of the Yash 10. According to this interpretation, while preserving the core characteristic of the Indo-Iranian Mithra, the Avestan Mithra also came to absorb certain aggressive or negative or dark functions originally associated with Varuna. Mithra is, in several respects, a deity of intermediate spaces. By crossing the heavens in his chariot, he establishes a link between earth and sun, while also ensuring proper mediation between contracting parties. He is likewise situated in the middle of time. In the Zoroastrian calendar, the 7 months is dedicated to him, as is the 16th day of each month. This calendrical positioning reflects a structured centrality. Within the monthly cycle, Mithra follows immediately after Ormazd, here called Dadush in the calendar, underscoring his elevated status, and in turn followed by his two attendants, as you can see just below his name, Sraosha and Rashnu, who accompany his celestial journey. This intermediate position, both physical and metaphysical, is also recorded in the Middle Platonist author Plutarch in the first century. In the Iside et Osiride 46, he refers to the Zoroastrian cosmogonic scheme of two opposing principles, good and evil, and he states, between the two was Mithra. This is why the Persians called the mediator Mithras. The Greek term here, mesites, denotes precisely such a mediating position between two parties in a juridical context, an arbitrator, umpire, or intercessor who guarantees the fulfillment of the terms stipulated in a covenant or agreement. This text of Plutarch finds an echo in a later apocalyptic composition, the Zendavarmanias in Middle Persian, in which Mithra's mediating role becomes explicitly active. The narrative is set at the end of time, when eschatological saviors arise in order to restore the primordial purity of the world and progressively bring evil to an end. In this context, Ahriman, the demon, the principle of evil, rebels against this process and appeals to Mir, asking him to redress what he perceives as an injustice to him. According to the primordial creation pact between Ormazd and Ahriman, they agree that each would in turn dominate creation for a period of 2,000 years. So that was the primordial contract. In response to Ahriman's complaint, Mir recalls the term of this original contract and points out that three of his generals, Dahog, Frasiob, and Alexander, have caused the allotted period to be exceeded by 1,000 years, and that a breach of covenant has therefore occurred on his side. So he is the contract breaker. What emerges from this narrative is that Mithra's judicial function does not consist in pronouncing a verdict, but rather in acting as a guarantor, a witness of an agreement concluded between two opposing parties. In this sense, his authority is fundamentally rooted in the validation of oath. Unfortunately, we possess only limited information concerning oath rituals in ancient Iran. However, we are somewhat better informed about a complementary dimension of oath practice, namely ordeal, vara in Avestan, which is not placed under Mithra's authority, but rather under that of his associate, Rashnu. The two notions, oath and ordeals, later conflated, and the expression to drink sulfur, which likely originally formed part of an ordeal ritual, eventually came to mean simply to swear an oath, to take an oath. When an individual swore an oath, he invokes the deity as a solemn witness, calling upon his name, and when required by the judicial system, he might be subjected to a test, an ordeal, exposing him to physical danger, such as walking on over burning embers, or having molten metal poured over his body, or consuming dangerous substances like sulfur. It is also possible that oath-taking rituals involved the symbolic use of weapons in certain cases. There is very little textual evidence for this, but what exists is, and what exists is relatively late, so it dates from the Islamic period. Yet one particularly striking account is found in the work of the ninth century scholar and theologian Abu Isa al-Warraq, who shows a marked interest in dualistic system and to Zoroastrian rituals. According to him, when the pact was sealed between Ormazd and Ahriman, each party entrusted its sword to four witnesses, including Mithra and Sraosha. The stipulation was that whoever violated the terms of the agreement would be killed with its own sword. Although no iconographic source for this ritual has survived, we can still reconstruct it with, let's say, artificial intelligence. In Greek and Armenian literature, numerous examples likewise attest that Achaemenid and Arsacid rulers swore oath by invoking Mithra as a witness. In both Anabasis, Cyropaedia, Xenophon report that the Persian king swore by Mithra, and there are many, many examples of this. What is less well known is the fact that this practice is also reflected in classical Persian literature, particularly in the pre-Islamic or the Iranian poem rooted in pre-Islamic Iran, such as the Shahnameh or Viseramin. In this context, the word mehr, meaning son, and its synonym aftab is used, and different characters take the son, aftab, as the witness to their oath. As I mentioned earlier, the word mihr came to mean love in Persian. It also happens that Mithra served as the guarantor of amorous oath. This Sogdian marriage contract, which Franz Grenet knows very well, from the early 8th century CE, sees a man pledged before Mithra that he will neither sell nor enslave his wife, a provision that can be seen as a striking expression of conjugal commitment. To conclude this overview, I would like to mention the festival dedicated to the deity, Mihragan or Mihrakana, which is still celebrated today. In the Zoroastrian religious calendar, it is observed when the 7 months Mithra and the 16th day of the month coincide. This correspondence is the 2 of October, although the festival originally appears to have been aligned with the autumn equinox. It is described as the mirror image of Nowruz, which marks the spring equinox. Thanks to Abu Rayhan al-Biruni, we possess several indications concerning the festival. Its date, of course, which is described as a major celebration, marking the appearance of the sun in the sky. The ritual dimension, both royal and popular, included Sasanian kings placing a solar crown upon their heads, evoking the sun mounted in his chariot. So the crown is described as having the chariot on it. And it's also said that there are public markets everywhere. It has also a mythological framework, so it describes that the Mihragan celebrates the victory of Fredon over Zahak. This is what the image you can see on the Sasanian seal. And so many of the Zoroastrian festival has a etiological narrative grounded on mythology. One of Biruni's sources further states that on this day, God established a covenant between light and darkness, an evident allusion to the equinox, the astronomical phenomenon most readily associated with balance and equilibrium. The festival also contains an eschatological dimension. Whereas Nowruz commemorates the beginning of the world, Mihragan evokes its end, insofar as autumn marks the cessation of vegetal and animal reproduction. This passage by Biruni merits comment, as although it does not explicitly refer to Mithra as the judge of the afterlife, it nonetheless alludes to his role in the afterlife. Indeed, the ascent of the deceased soul is compared to the rising sun on the fourth morning after death. This is based on a specific Avestan passage in the Vedic 1928, in which it is said that after the soul has endured the trial of the first 3 nights, Mithra ascends the mountain at dawn on the fourth morning and the sun rises. For the soul of the deceased, the arrival of daybreak brought about by Mithra's arrival corresponds to the vision of salvation in the afterlife. Biruni additionally mentions a festival celebrated 5 days later, known as the Great Mihragon. This calendrical duplication results from the drift of the calendar when intercalary days, the epagomenal days, were not consistently inserted into the annual cycle. Other sources attest practices associated with the occasion of Mithrakana, including wine consumption. Biruni doesn't talk about it, but we have other sources, like Ctesias, who mentioned that Mihrakana is the only occasion in which the Persian king can appear in public intoxicated. Other sources mention also gift exchange, like in the Nowruz rituals. Strabo, for instance, mentioned the sending of 20,000 horses to the Persian king from Armenia. There is also a renewal of garments, of dresses, and also the importance of music during Mihragan festival. We have at least two author, Nezami and Al-Farabi, that refer to melodies composed specifically for this occasion. It is well known that the festival of Mihragan, like the Nowruz, survived the Islamization of Iran, and that Arabic poems were composed on this occasion for the Abbasid caliphs. The festival is still celebrated today in Iran with considerable splendor, although it must be acknowledged that Mithra's primary functions as the Lord of Covenant no longer occupy a central position. As you can see in this photo, even his iconography and his solar halo have been reattributed to a major rival, the figure of the prophet Zoroaster, who is now often associated with a form of monotheism. The ancient Lord of Contracts may thus, like his Roman counterpart, ultimately become a figure of mystery. Thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.